Welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Andy Cleff, and I'm delighted today to have two guests. I'll introduce them in a minute. Our overarching theme is going to be Agile HR BFFs, and we'll see where we go. Wayne Tarkin, tell us a little bit about yourself.
First of all, Andy and Mitch, glad to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm one of those, glutton for punishments. I've been trying to adopt Agile principles to HR. I had a 20-year background in HR, took a slight diversion into IT, was developing software as a scrum master for IBM and then Comcast. And I saw the power of Agile to do things that I hadn't really seen in HR, and that was actually get things done, you know, take long, big enterprise projects, applicant tracking, ERPs, and actually make them work. So I've been on a mission for the last 5 years to really take some of the key aspects of Agile, and we call it mimicking some of the key artifacts and rituals and applying it to the non-IT person. And so we started a course at the University of Pennsylvania doing that. We're also working with several clients on those who are interested in looking at Agile ways to improve HR.
Awesome. So we'll look at it from through that lens. And Mitch Goldstein, welcome.
Thanks, Andy. Great to be here.
What's your elevator speech? What's an elevator? What's an elevator? Anyway.
I don't know. I've never been on a descender, so I assume an elevator is something that takes you up.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a senior Agile coach with Accenture Solutions IQ. I've been banging around Agile for almost two decades, and I'm very excited to hear that people are starting to adopt these values and principles in other aspects of enterprise. So this is great.
Yeah, it doesn't always start with technology. So Wayne, how have you brought Agile practices into the HR space? Just give us a quick, how do you get invited in?
The challenge in HR, any bit non-IT is, you know, when you say Agile, I think it's IT. And what we try to do is you try to lift the veil of mystery around Agile. It's not pure IT. What we've done, we've taken some of the key elements, like how you meet, how you plan, how you document or don't document things, and applied that to the business world. And so if a programmer looked at our offering, they would first say, well, that doesn't really look like Agile. But as they looked at it more deeply, they would say, I see some of the core principles. We're breaking a big thing down to small pieces. We're doing incremental improvements. We're doing 2 to 3 week story, you know, sprints and things like that. So it's a slow adoption. I think most HR leaders are still stuck in their old ways. But I think, you know, there's a high level frustration that HR can't keep up with the changes. They had a challenge in 2020, 2021, they're going to be additional challenges. And so what Agile does is you can't really predict the challenges. All you can do is get ready for them and be able to respond more quickly. And Agile, because it delayers organizations, it's more transparent. It just helps companies be more efficient and more agile in terms of responding to situations.
Yeah. I want to flip it around and toss it over to you, Mitch. How can HR practices, framework agnostic, support the software transformation to agility? What needs to change from there, from that perspective?
The few times that I've done this, Andy, I've actually gone through the exercise of posting up the Agile manifesto as written and taking a red pen to it and making some key changes that change the kind of ground sense of where it came from. So the classic example is that the seventh Agile principle, for example, is working software is the primary measure of progress. Well, HR doesn't have working software, and banana processing companies don't, and cookie bakers don't. And so what do they have? So we rewrite this and we say demonstrable product or marketable product is the primary measure of progress. In this case, it might be happy onboarded employees are the primary measure of progress. And we tune the kind of grounding ideas of the manifesto into the business that we're applying it in.
Makes a lot of sense. Particularly when take something like hiring, right? Bringing in new people to a team, Kanban, right? And it's cycle time. And you're not done when they're just brought in, but it's the life cycle of the employee. Do they stick around? So much to take from that.
Yeah, I think there's a bifurcation of Agile in terms of large organizations and mid-sized and smaller organizations in the non-IT area. I think a company like IBM has done a lot of innovative things in terms of their talent. We had a speaker from kind of the head of talent acquisition, and they had combined Agile with artificial intelligence to reduce days to fill by 80%.
Wow.
And, they have 300,000 employees, so they have the resources to do that. Whereas you talk to a company with 5,000 and they're not even, they may still be using Excel primarily as their operating system. So, but it is possible, and we've seen, cases like ING and again, IBM, I think Google and some others have really used Agile in a way to kind of create more efficiencies and more engagement. The issue is, how can we, translate that to other organizations?
Yeah, no argument there. I still want to try to figure out the other side of this. So HR deals with compensation, performance management, how people are viewed within the organization, organizational structure, the design, right? So separate out HR using agile practices to serve their customers, right? This other track of organization by design and performance by design, when we build things in an agile way, team structures are radically different, individual contributions are different, hierarchies, performance, all that stuff has to change as well. And toss up, how are you seeing the HR function respond to this type of demand from new ways of working across the entire org? How do they support it? Or what are they actively doing to keep the viscosity in this system?
Well, I think they've been reacting slowly. Again, I don't think most companies haven't really gotten it yet. They really haven't move towards Agile. There's always a question, do we do Agile for the organization or Agile for HR, right? And so that's a decision. But to Mitch's point, if we don't have the right kind of performance system to measure teams versus individuals, to measure output versus activity, then it's not going to work. And so one of the inhibitors of Agile is that, we haven't really adopted our systems, our management systems to respond to that. So that's changing. I think you're seeing more networked organizations. They realize the power of teams, but you still see hierarchy, you still see bureaucracy. Those things aren't going to go away. There's always a yin yang in an organization between bureaucracy and innovation, and HR, role is hopefully in the future is to kind of allow more innovation, more newer structures to take hold.
Yeah. Hey, Jonathan, welcome. Glad you could jump right in. Came at a great time. We were looking, just before you joined, we were talking, sorry, listeners, you already heard this, but Jonathan didn't, talking about using HR practices, using agile practices within HR, right? Helping them Scrum, Kanban, that sort of thing, adapting the manifesto to their business practices. And now we're on track two, which is looking at how the HR function supports organizational agility and networking. And I know this is a passion of yours. So what do we need from HR to support better collaboration, meaningful compensation, meaningful performance management, and stop calling people resources?
Yeah, and it's kind of hard to start that journey because, the whole department is named after something that's something we're trying to avoid, right? So it's an interesting conundrum. And yet we kind of, once again, get through it and try to get, do what we can. But you guys had a great segue already, right? It's, you know, are these frameworks, these processes, these things that we do applicable? Well, that's not even really the real win here. It's organizational agility. How do we move fast? How do we move forward? And once again, I think all of us would agree, people are at the heart of it. And if people are at the heart of it, well, HR and or people organizations, there's a lot of different names now spouting out instead of HR, which is a whole different topic, but their role in being servant leaders, giving the right type of coaching and training and mentorship to people to how to handle things situationally with people, what motivates them, what's not motivating them, truly be empathetic towards people's roles, what it takes, how do you build mastery, purpose, and all that great stuff that, you know, ultimately what gives people drive? That's the kind of whole thing around my rant is, mastery, purpose, autonomy. Everybody's familiar with that and that kind of trifecta. If you establish all three, you get drive. And that's the number one thing every leadership wants to hear when their employees. I want them to be motivated and show up to work and solve problems and improve my organization. Okay, a process will help you get there. Tools help you get there. But you know, organizational agility, you're talking about people being motivated, people having drive. And I feel like HR has a critical role in that. They do. I think they're the people that set the foundation to hold people accountable to do it, really. That's kind of how I would frame it. But I'm curious, you know, Mitch or Wayne, do you have things to say to that?
I think an interesting spin on what you're driving at, John, is that when we talk about agility and organizational agility, business agility, we're talking about whatever the scope of the organization is, of making that a learning organization. So I think that there's certain things about Agile, and I mean the big box Agile, I'm not restricting it to the manifesto, but I would bring in all modern techniques that I think we can kind of box under Lean Agile or XP type, all of these type of practices all do have their applicability no matter where you map them out. And the trick is, I think John already mentioned it, is to figure out, well, what's the value? What is it that we're selling here? What comes out the other side of what it is that we're making? And identify that as the value stream. And then using principles like lean theory, lean software development, kind of leans heavily on the software side, but manufacturing lean theory and theory of constraints is another great way to uncover some of the issues and to understand better how value flows through a non-IT entity.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think a lot of companies are talking, you know, they use the term employee experience now more than they have in the past, which my mind's the same as customer experience, but internal. And so, although a lot of people don't view it that way. And so the companies that really get it, they, you know, they work backwards from the customer, right? They look at frontline employees as the kind of main constituents for HR policies and practices. The challenge in HR is typically they have more than they can handle, more to do, and they don't, HR leaders don't know sometimes how to say no. And so what the beauty of Agile is, it kind of creates more of a structure and accountability around products and offerings and things you do. And so we recommend, you know, you kind of come up with an epic and roadmaps, and you break it down into small pieces and you schedule them. The challenge in HR is, you know, typically you don't have people full time, right? I'm not a full time programmer doing X. I'm doing Agile, but I got five other things to do. And so there's a balance there. But by having that rigor of creating some consistency and some form and structure around Agile, I think, you know, it's a lot easier for an HR leader to drive some accountability. And I think Andy mentioned Kanban board. I think some companies that are starting to use that, it's Kanban. That's the thing about Kanban. You can see where you are. You can see what's going on. And that's helpful to people who work hard, but don't really see much improvement, much progress. And so, you know, a lot of companies we talk to, we recommend that as a first step.
I want to bring it back to a favorite topic of mine, performance management. You've touched on accountability and things like that. And we have all walked into dreadful situations that are created by the various platforms. Jira, ADO, all have an assignee field. which is a single person. And it just so contrary to, it's a team goal. And that becomes somewhat of a perverse thing. And we're dealing with managers that look still at individual performance rather than team performance, because that's tied back to the annual review cycle, that's tied back to the HR plan. Has anybody been able to start to dismantle that in any scale?
Yes.
Tell us.
All right. So the secret to this was that we actually thought of several work streams, and we generalized three work streams. Number one work stream was finding and bringing in new employees. In other words, value was satisfied when we fulfilled a requisition for a new employee. The other one was the annual performance review. Where that work stream would be satisfied when the review is complete, promotions, increases, bonuses, et cetera, title changes, whatever came with that was all part of that. And the third one was incident handling. And incident handling was for all of the other processes besides the, anytime there was an issue or an anomaly, EOC complaints, all of these things then fell into this kind of miscellaneous bucket. And we used Kanban systems to keep track of all of these things very publicly without exposing anyone's personal information, but everybody knew at a glance where everybody was in the hiring process. And this was a fairly large company, I would say 15 to 25,000 employees. So very high turnover just by the numbers, and a very, very busy group, limited number of recruiters. We used the same system to make sure that we had requests for developers and technicians and other subject matter experts to participate in interviews. All these things were coordinated through these HR Kanban systems that were very public and very available.
I'm still afraid I'm not getting my point across. Johnson, you're going to have to help me. So that is agile in HR. And I can see how that's, Mitch, what you described is a beautiful thing, and you look at it as value stream. But I want to say, how does HR support organizational agility at scale?
So, and I'll even see what Mitch is, see if it kind of comes out of what you actually just talked about, Mitch, where let's say it goes back to, we sometimes, I'll use a sports analogy, actually. We sometimes have a sports team that actually loves their coach, their head coach. He's a great person. He builds them up, but their record still doesn't make them to the playoffs. Is that a successful outcome of a team? You build character. People love the person. They actually did a great job, but they didn't necessarily win. Is that, would you say that was good agility or good improvement on the organization? The reason why I bring up that analogy is that coach is really paid to do one thing, which is win, get them to the playoffs and progress. So their conflict of interest of whether or not the players like them or not is more secondary, third or fourth in their priority list, because his goal is to win and achieve. So this goes back to why I brought this analogy up. Our leaders, managers, and most of the companies that are public for sure, their goal is to change the stock price, drive revenue, that's their priority, right? So if they're also accountable for the people relationship driving organizational agility, which we're kind of talking about as a people-driven initiative, it's hard to say, well, if your people are happier, it'll drive your revenue. That's a hard, fuzzy metric and KPI for managers to consume. And there isn't really great quantitative data showing that. Usually it's very qualitative. So Mitch, going back to what you said, you had a great engine, it sounded like, and visibility and transparency of the work that was going on. My challenge to that would be, were the people happier doing it? Did it motivate them? And did it make the managers and leaders better people going through that? And how do you know?
Oh, absolutely. And I could tell you how I know. Because we ended our fiscal year at the end of June, which is fairly typical. And we knew that before then, April and May were going to be extremely painful months. Trying to get all of the necessary things together for a review. So where we injected the agility was, number one, to establish a much tighter cadence, and instead of having an annual cadence, to have a quarterly cadence, and instead of having a review, to have a retrospective rather than a review. So a review is basically, and I don't want to pick on John, but you know, John, this is what you did well, and this is what you didn't do well. And because of that, we're going to reward you as possible. In a retrospective, that's not how we do it. In a retrospective, I say, okay, John, you tell me, what'd you do well? What didn't you do well? What could you do better next time? What do you think your reward should be? And I can tell you, when people are allowed to articulate that, they become very, very engaged in that conversation.
I'd crank that up to 11 and have the team do the retro.
It works. And the team is who does the retro. And I can tell you the reason why it was great was because all of the burden to do all of this work came off the managers and onto the teams without disrupting the value delivery that the teams were doing. And this is actually an interesting phenomenon, which I think bears bringing up here, which is that we always think of ourselves as being on a team. Typically, everybody is on multiple teams all the time. Right. But there's one team that we're chiefly identify ourselves with, and that would be the team that we deliver value for primarily. And we call that team one or team prime, the team that you are expected to be delivering value for. But you are a member of multiple different types of orthogonal teams as well. For example, I'm a member of the coaching team for SIQ, and that's my team prime. When I go to a client, I then become a member of whatever team it is that I'm coaching as a secondary team. So we have to think about all of those connections in this idea of to whom are you accountable? Because it turns out you're accountable to much more than your team prime. You're accountable to every team that you participate in to one degree or another.
Yeah.
So it's important to keep that a part of the calculus.
And if that's taking it up to 11, I almost want to take it to like 50, which is, imagine a director, VP, senior, you know, very executive, very high profile person, where the outcome of how they have been doing is a retrospective of the team evaluating that leader's ability to be a servant leader. And now they're purely rewarded based off how the team says, yeah, they were a servant leader. They helped me do this. They enabled us. They could. And that would be very interesting if, you know, purely they're rewarded based off how they actually led, right?
Yeah. And it's not on an annual basis and suffering from recency bias. It's on a quarterly effect. And I would add one more component to the retro is not just how did you do, what can you do better, and the team's view of that, but it's the accountability equation that's bi-directional. How can the team support you on this continual deliberate development journey? Because, you know, my backhand sucks, right? I got a great forehand, but I need somebody to practice the backhand with. And so team, every time I flub the ball, you'd be like, let's do that 5 more times.
That would be a great mutual way to kind of align with the leader, right? Exactly. Because if they at least called out, if the team said, I don't have a good backhand, and the leader acknowledged that, now there's a level set expectation of I'll help you. And then that gives me the, you know, you get a skill set. I even love that. Yes.
Are you seeing that, Wayne? So you have a class, and it's I forget the title, but it's, you know, agile leadership. Yep. And is this type of thought part of the curriculum?
Yes. So we have students who are not just HR, so we have a little broader focus, but our focus is on how can people practices be modified to improve performance in an organization, right? And using agile techniques. And so things like performance management, as Mitch said, that, you know, we have to move from an annual focus to more frequent quarterly focus, with self-nomination, self-assessments, team assessments. We have to look at how we plan in HR, how we budget, the budgeting process. You know, it's annual review. It takes forever. It's painful. It's worse than root canal. And then, of course, it's not really followed. And so some companies are starting to reduce that and maybe budget on a quarterly basis and see new ventures, just like a venture capitalist would, right? They see things work. and they give a little more money and things like that. I mean, it's still early on. I don't want, you know, again, we have this misconception of we think HR is changing, but in the biggest companies with the most resources, yes, you will find these. But in the 98% of the other companies, as I said before, Excel is still the primary software tool that people use. And there's a lot to go, but it's getting better as technology becomes easier.
So I don't want to steal your thunder, Andy, but this is getting me really curious about a question then, which is, we just talked about, you know, Wayne, your scenario, which yours, and what would be HR's role then when we actually talk about success? Because when you really think about the people that we're talking about, the quantum makes this successful, whether it's IT leaders, finance leaders, supply chain leaders that are driving this change, they're still very accountable to the KPIs, the revenue, those outcomes. Yet HR has different outcomes of people. And there's like a misalignment because HR doesn't really have the people organizationally. The others do. So is there a shift or organizational design issue going on?
Well, I think HR really provides the foundation, can help nurture the foundation, can help nurture, you know, an experimentation culture, the culture that supports risk-taking, that supports, you know, learning fast as opposed to failing fast. And so those are things that HR should be focused on. Aside from the infrastructure like performance reviews and budgeting, they should be working on a culturization that is more of experimentation, and I have trust and I feel that I can contribute, I can feel that I can question. The greatest thing about the COVID is the transparency level in organizations has really gone through the roof. You have never seen CEOs admitted that I don't know something, right? But last March, a lot of people said, I don't know how to respond. I've never had this before. And so that was refreshing to many employees. And why engagement was so high is because people realized that, you know, we're all in this together. And so the problem is, you know, 2021, do we revert back to the old ways? And it's kind of, I tell you what to do, not we figure it out together. And so to me, HR really is focused on the culture. Can we create and sustain and improve a culture that encourages the things we're talking about, like networking and collaboration and sharing, right? Because most organizations don't share very well. We have great systems. Well, we have too many systems. And the more systems we have, the less we share, right? Because everybody uses their own system and is, you know. So that's the role of HR is, can we promote that culture and those people mental models and change folks so that they, you know, respond and they're more willing to share and trust.
What incentives and where do they come from to make this change, this shift happen?
I think when people are personally involved with these decisions, it speaks directly to their motivation for success. I know a lot of my colleagues over the years would shy away from participating in interviews because part of the interview process is putting yourself out there and really kind of banking on the results, especially when you're a hiring manager. You're directly on the hook for everybody who comes into the company. So how is it that you make it so that you don't have that sense of leadership on the hook for every activity that's undertaken? And so this idea of pushing things down and distributing that information, it's okay right up until the point in time where in any sort of liability is invoked. Then you have to push the decision back up to management. But I think any decision short of the actual hire, no hire decision, that should rest with the team that's hiring the person. And that may sound absolutely ludicrous, but I can tell you it's a big difference than having a pool of people and plucking people from a pool.
So let me pick on the org design for a sec as well. But Andy, do you want to go first real quick or do you want me to go?
No, keep going. I want to come back to the concept of a single hiring manager versus a team decision.
Oh, okay. And that might segue actually off of what I'm going to bring up, which is Wayne, you were talking about how maybe the role of what HR is supposed to do is kind of help provide that foundation, comfort level, education, and knowledge that kind of is supposed to be leveraged among those groups. Thinking outside the box, what if instead of having it be an organization that's kind of dedicated to that, it was more of a center of excellence and matrix community where the roles were actually embedded within the departments that had to do it. Where now it's not like HR is telling us, it's they're part of our team. Like we have to listen to them. They're part of the team.
Yeah.
I don't know if that sounds extreme, but.
No, I mean, absolutely. HR doesn't hire, I mean, as Mitch was saying, they don't have responsibility for hiring people. They provide candidates and decisions right. made, but you know, they certainly can create the environment and train people, right? So we want to if Mitch is a supervisor, right? And we're getting complaints, we'll talk with him about some of his style. We'll talk to him, can he build some trust? We'll talk to him about, you know, shared leadership, letting people, being facilitating of his team, not telling him what to do, right? And so we would do that across the organization. You know, the challenge is you have these training programs that last for a day and people feel excited, but then they go back to the real world and nothing happens, right? So you need to coach people. You need to hold them accountable. You know, we have a lot more data around people now than we ever had before. We have sentiment analysis. We have other analytics. So you can identify, you know, managers who are making it and who are not. And we can identify where their problems are. And so In a perfect world, HR would, the role should really be to kind of respond to those things. If I see that there's a certain Jonathan is leading group and they're not performing well because there's a lack of trust, then that's where I need to spend my time. I need to spend time with him. I need to spend time with the team, kind of building that trust up. So the proof is the pudding is where the people actually do the work. HR just helps them do it more effectively.
Yeah, there's a lot of data behind it, particularly out of Google's study, what made good managers, and it was exactly trust, right? And so forth. But, you know, if there's a system in place that says, Mitch, you're the hiring manager, right?
That's happened.
That's problematic because now Mitch has to make the decision and all accountability rests on him. And the team's like, yeah, Mitch hired another winner.
I'm glad you brought this up because
make it a team function. Make hiring a team function and maybe someday firing a team function, but there's liability there. So start with moving it from Mitch is accountable to it's a team decision.
Here's the problem with that kind of accountability. Let's just revert temporarily. If we're talking about agile in an IT environment and you're talking about level, you know, applying quality to building and integrating and testing and delivery of software. If you make a mistake, well, you know, there's a decent chance that you'll catch it if you have a decent DevOps before it gets out in the wild. And you could probably fix it and you might get some capital loss or you might hurt a customer relationship or you might blow a sales opportunity. When you make a mistake in the HR place, you're in a whole different zone. So what's the equivalent? And I'm sorry to answer a question with a question, but what's the equivalent of a safe place to fail in the HR world where you might bring someone on board who is difficult or litigious or dangerous? And now failure now becomes unacceptably large from a liability standpoint. So it's a real interesting problem. So what you have to do is you still have to make some sort of liability-oriented stage gate decision. But what you do is you take everything up to that point away from the hiring manager. What it does is the team has a certain obligation to provide a case, a business case, for a hiring or not hiring of any given individual. And it's up to leadership, you know, because of the nature of it, it's up to leadership to make that decision. For example, it may turn out upon reflection that someone has something bad in a criminal record. Well, it doesn't matter how much you like them, we have to face, and those problems do come up. You're in a position where you can't have decisions that have tremendous scope of effect or tremendous economic impact or tremendous liability. We cannot disseminate those to teams. That has to be centralized.
Well, given that hiring is an imprecise process, right? But it's becoming less so with analytics and data and getting group interviewing and stuff like that. I think you can reduce some of the risk. And I think if a manager follows that and there's a broad consensus and the candidate doesn't work out, it's a lot better than if the hiring manager didn't go through that and said, I like this guy. He feels right to me, right? And he didn't really follow the procedure. That's where the bigger risk is, right? Because they're using their gut feeling, which unfortunately is primarily the case. But if you have a system in place, then you get a bad hire. The question is, what went wrong with the system? How can we fix that? That becomes an improvement opportunity, right? So what analytics didn't we see? What piece of data didn't we analyze to do that? And so it's less of a individual focus. It's more of a process, and how can we improve that?
One of the things that we built into the client's Agile HR process is we had a post-mortem. And a post-mortem basically said, irrespective of the hire, no hire decision, to review the entire process, to kind of walk through it. If it was a no hire decision, at what point was it? You want to make your no hire decisions as early as possible to save time and effort of interviewing someone who's not going to end up eligible. So that's a form of retrospection, but it's not a periodic retrospection. It's more, I call it a post-mortem. It's more like an autopsy, like how did things get the way that they got, rather than focusing on that. And yes, I think it's important to talk about kind of the meta hire, not just the hire itself, but the process behind the hire and retrospect around that at the same time. So if someone does get through and say, I'm trying to think of something innocuous, say it does turn out that somebody has a criminal record and we find out very late in the hire process, we might want to say, okay, from now on, before we commit anybody's time, these things have to happen first. And it sounds a little stage-gatey, but it's really, it's just self-protection. We don't want to put anybody into the system, and we want to get them out of the system as fast as possible.
We have one more topic before we wrap. So the people ops or the HR group, their role in supporting leaders at all levels come up with, I don't want to say hierarchy, but that's still what's in place, org design, reporting structures, and then you take any scaling mechanism and you figure out, well, maybe there's a matrix here. How does HR facilitate and support that?
So I'm going to go out and say something extreme just to see how the crowd responds. I am currently a director over a space of engineers. I'm accountable for tons of delivery, tons of outcomes, KPIs, revenue targets, all that stuff, while also having the HR responsibilities of leading the people, being a servant leader, our culture and all that on the team. Why? Like that's an unrealistic expectation, in my opinion. To do it both effectively, one's going to give. And that's just how it's going. And that's very common in a lot of organizations, but that's what I'm up against. And my proposal would be, if the people underneath you are underneath you hierarchically, then you should not have any bearing on what they're delivering, the outcomes or the KPIs. You should be selfishly focused on, are they happy? Are you fulfilling their needs? Are you being a servant leader to that group to make sure there's things out of their way where they're taking their initiative of deliveries, outcomes, and stuff they need from a product or like someone in the lead space that's actually needing the tactical deliveries they're doing and the skills they provide. I am both right now. And sometimes it's actually the extreme of one where the people underneath are only the people on above all those people are only wanting the deliveries and outcomes, and it's at all costs, right? Sometimes I'll hit this KPI at all costs, even no matter what the outcome is, meaning my people will hate me. I make them work overtime. That's a real scenario that happens a lot. So my two cents is we should really have structures of organization, knowing that hierarchy is not going to go away anytime soon because it's such a embedded in our processes for how people ops and HR works, that maybe the solution is that structure, when you look at hierarchy, should be where your support, mentorship, and coaching is coming from, not where the delivery and accountability of what you need to do is coming from. But they're co-joined.
Which creates the tension that you've just described.
I actually think in most organizations, it seems to me HR has almost what you would call in safe parlance a shared services characteristic more than a delivery team. Everybody needs HR at one point or another. They're on demand, right? We fire them up when we need hires. If we're not hiring people, then we can take some cycles away from the people who are spending most of their time hiring and have them do other things. So it's kind of interesting to look at it from that perspective, HR as a corporate service. And its role in organization design then becomes very small because they basically become consultants to the entire organization as client. Now, I could see a whole different scenario where HR is the place where organizational design occurs. That's almost never true because of what we just talked about. The Taylorism sort of has this inherent hierarchy to it. And it's going to take probably another 100 years for us to blow that up. So we're stuck with hierarchy as it is right now. So HR tends to have, you know, a very lagging role in participating. For example, if I went to HR, totally theoretical, and I say, I need 5 developers and 2 QA people. HR is not going to push back and say, you know, why are you doing that? It's like, why don't you balance that out? They're not part of that decision. Their job is just kind of, you know, they're just a black box to the organization. So I would like to break that constraint. And I would like to say HR should have some sort of oversight role to make sure that the organization is functional and balanced and populated with, you know, talented people who are motivated.
Now you're speaking my language, because that would be interesting, because one of the number one things I've been exposed to when people really take the word agile and the principles and what it does seriously is how much work are you really doing that's valuable? And when you start to think about what you just said, Mitch, and are you using your people effectively? Are they right, focusing on the right things at the right time? Somebody in HR that, or at least maybe, and let's use IT as an example, has an IT background but couldn't strategically help how to align the people to be effective. That's an interesting conversation. I need, you know, 5 developers and 2 QA people. Well, do you? Because we have some other work going on over here where maybe we can repurpose that, and it's an organizational design discussion on value, right?
Right. And you're also saving the sunk cost of having to go out and find people when you have made perfectly talented people right under your nose. That should be HR's job, to find people first. Yeah.
And I need to be clear about something, because what I just said sounds very like resource managing. Just be clear, because it's like, oh, you're going to move people around. And no, that's not true. What you're doing is exposing a problem that you need to raise to those product owners or those product managers and let the teams shift, because the value's here, not here.
Yes. And then you come into the other constraint of the team wants to shift, but they then report to someone else who controls the budget that is funded, and then it all blows up all over again.
And that's why it never happens. Yep. Because now you're going to ruin their annual compensation, their AOP planning, their, yep, exactly.
I know it's going to be painful to bring up, but it bears bringing up that when you talk about lean budgeting, this is the problem that you have. Lean budgeting is, there's a huge operating premise that teams are long-lived and stable. And that's another word for permanent. So it kind of smashes to pieces this whole idea of organizational agility, meaning that people, you are what you do, basically. This whole idea of roles and responsibilities, we chuck that out the window and we say, you are what you do. If you want to do something different, then you learn how to do something different and do it. But you are what you do, and your contribution is what's important, not your 3-letter abbreviations after your name and not your resume. That your contributions what matter.
Well, you know, there's a yin and yang between bureaucracy and innovation. You need some bureaucracy, right? We have to pay the bills, we have to keep the lights on, we have to make payroll. And so those things are never going away, but we certainly can promote more innovation in organizations. And the problem in HR is that they're overwhelmed by business as usual activities like doing payroll and hiring and things like that. They don't really have the time for proactively coaching and talking to you about, you need 5 developers. Well, we have some people over here, or do you really need 5 developers? What are you trying to do? Maybe there's a more efficient way to do that, things like that. So that, in a perfect world, that would be the way I would like to structure HR, to be able to be more like coaches and consultants internally. In fact, there are some softwares being developed called internal marketplaces, where they're actually going to have free agents inside, where they can pull people from different into different projects. It's still early on, but I think one of the outcomes of the COVID with all the layoffs, companies realized we didn't want to lay people off. We don't want to lose them. And so how can we create a better way to manage people internally, which currently sucks? Most companies will hire 1,000 people and then they'll fire 1,000 people the same day. It's just the way it works. And I'm saying it's right, but so there is some looking, there is a some the latest technology is talking about internal free agent marketplace. How can we better align talent? The question is, you know, who owns the talent, right? Because typically I have to own this talent. This is my person. This is my rec. And so it's a different focus.
Yeah. So it's a fundamental thing. So if Mitch is right, another 100 years when we have this conversation, well, we'll be things there will be solved.
Yeah, Andy, I already put it on my calendar. We'll try to have it on February 8th if we can in 100 years.
Well, gentlemen, fascinating conversation. It's about the end of the time. I'm going to give each of you a chance to shout out any upcoming events, share the best way for people to get in touch with you. Wayne.
We're teaching a course, graduate course at Penn. We're also going to be having some we call curtain raisers, which are kind of previews, 2 hour, half a day. We actually can offer certification credit for those. We're evangelists. Our goal here is to engage HR leaders and help them adopt some agile ways. We don't believe you have to be 100% agile. If you change the way you meet, if you change the way you plan, if you change the way you communicate, no 35 slide presentations, just 1 or 2 pages executive summaries. If you do any of those, you'll be more effective. And so, you know, the problem is agile zealots that you have to do everything from A to Z. And that doesn't work in a non-IT area, I think. So our focus is on that. So we Agile HR Consortium. We're on LinkedIn. We're a consortium of like-minded leaders from the globe who are really focused on this. So look forward to engaging you in the future.
Mitch, what's coming up?
Not a whole lot. I'm going to be getting more involved with Agile Uprising, hopefully pretty soon. We got some things that are brewing. You can always find me on LinkedIn at Mitch Goldstein. Always interesting conversations just seem to sprout up around me for some strange reason. But I want to leave just with this idea, which is that the very, very first line of the Agile Manifesto is, we're uncovering better ways of doing everything by doing it and helping others do it. And we can apply that to anything that we do.
Bravo. Jonester.
Yeah, so you can find me obviously in the Agile Uprising Discord. Very interesting conversations happening there. There's another community that is also global that's called Hands On Agile that I'm a part of as well. Great community in the Slack environment, and LinkedIn is probably the best way. Event-wise, Agile Uprising has a lot of good podcast content and a lot of things coming up. I highly recommend that you guys stay tuned.
All right. Thank you, Wayne Tarkin, Mitch Goldstein, and Jonathan Schneider for joining today. Thank you to our listening audience. If you enjoyed this episode, give us a rating. Leave some comments on your podcast platform of choice. If it's your first time tuning in, subscribe. Catch the next episode. And if you'd like to join the discussion, pop on over to agileuprising.com. You'll find a link to the Discord server that is really buzzing these days. Finally, support from listeners like you help us cover our hosting and podcast costs. So see the show notes for contact information for our guests and how you can become a patron. Till next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.